You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As most listeners to my show must know by now, Sarah Chase has been living and working in Kandahar, Afghanistan for the past 5 years. First as a reporter for National Public Radio, then as the director for the NGO Afghans for Civil Society, and now as the head of a company she started, Argan, that uses local agricultural products like almonds and roses to make artisanal soaps. She was here a few months back to talk about her book, The Punishment of Virtue Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban, and now she's written an article for the current issue of the Boston Review called Days of Lies and Roses, Selling Out Afghanistan, which affords us an opportunity to check in with her again. Hi, how are you doing, Sarah?
Great. How are you, Len?
I'm well. According to your article, one of the main things getting in the way of establishing a stable, equitable society in Afghanistan is corruption. How pervasive is the corruption?
Totally pervasive. And I sort of feel like a broken record, as you point out. You know, we've had these conversations in the past, and I kind of feel like I was playing this Cassandra thing back in 2002, saying, you know, we're ushering criminals back into Afghanistan to be our proxies, not only in chasing, you know, the remnants of Al-Qaeda and things like that, but then we installed them in positions of political power, and we're really reaping the harvest of that now. I mean, it is every single level of government from, you know, the highest cabinet ministers all the way down to the police officer on the street corner. I mean, you've got deployments of Afghan National Army soldiers to, you know, areas of combat where they will man checkpoints and literally shake down every single person that goes through their checkpoint for, you know, the money in their pockets, for cell phone, for anything that moves, basically. And people are really disgusted with it.
And it's not just that. You talk about having to pay bribes to get an electricity meter.
Everything.
And you try to do business, everything through customs you have to pay a bribe for?
Yeah. Well, for our cooperative, we wanted to, you know, register as a cooperative with the agriculture ministry. And it wasn't happening for about 5 months. I would send our treasurer, who is a Kandahari, and at that time was running an Italian NGO, you know, nonprofit organization in Kandahar. You know, I mean, a guy who's very, you know, I mean, he's not a goat herd, is what I'm trying to say. And he would drive out to this office once a week for 5 months, and nothing happened. And I finally went. I don't pay bribes, but being a foreigner that they think has a big mouth, that government officials think has a big mouth, has it.
How did they get that idea, Sarah?
And so I basically stamped my foot, and we finally got our thing registered. Customs, the UN back in 2002 or 3, I think it was, did a kind of back-of-the-envelope calculation on how much money was coming into Kandahar. Interestingly, customs is not on the border. It's at Kandahar, which is about an hour and a half inside the border. And this is, you know, one of the two roads that joins roughly the Iranian plateau, Central Asia, and the Indian subcontinent. It's a pretty powerful road in terms of commerce. And UN calculated there should be $5 to $8 million a month in customs dues coming in, and it's this massively opaque thing. Nobody knows how much money is coming in. There's like a special extra reconstruction tax that goes direct into the governor's pocket. Do not pass go and do not account. I mean, it's crazy. And then, of course, you throw opium into the mix, and there are just all kinds of ways that public officials can make money off of opium that don't necessarily include, you know, planting poppies and collecting, you know, the sap.
But, you know, Sarah, many developing countries have issues with corruption, and even developed countries in some cases. Have we just been conditioned to take corruption and this sort of thing for granted?
You know, I think to some degree we have been so conditioned. And one of the things that really gets me irritated is when people, you know, will sort of say, oh, this is South Asia. You know, look at India, look at Pakistan. Everybody's corrupt. And this is just the way it is. And that usually makes my blood boil because I don't believe in, you know, never changing cultural or social traits. I think that societies are a product of certain tendencies, sometimes conflicting tendencies, plus specific historical events that bring one or another tendency to the fore. And something that's really interesting is that, you know, again, back in 2002, my Kandahari friends would say, gosh, you know, the one decent thing about the Taliban was that they provided law and order. And so you could, you know, walk across town without being shaken down or being held up or, you know. Now I'm getting things like, you know what, the Taliban didn't take any bribes. And recently I was driving across town and my cooperative member who was in the truck with me, you know, kind of pointed out this guy. See that guy over there, that old guy? He used to be the head of the tailors union under the Taliban, and they caught him taking bribes, and they painted his face black, and they put rotten eggplants around his neck, like a necklace of rotten eggplants around his neck, and paraded him around town. And so what and also interestingly, the kind of last gasp communist government in, I would say, the very early 1989-1990 also gets credit for having been kind of upstanding and not treating the citizens as something to loot. And so I actually think that we got a little bit confused, the United States got a little bit confused back in 2002. We seem to have two objectives that didn't have to be contradictory, but the way that we pursued them was contradictory. One objective was, you know, to be cynical about it, cowboys and Al-Qaeda, you know what I mean, where you collect a posse and you go galloping off into the hills in chase of Al-Qaeda. And as we all know from Western movies, posses tend to be made up of pretty unsavory people, you know. So we collected some really unsavory people who had been repudiated by the Afghan population, and they became our posse. And then
you're talking about the local warlords.
Warlords,
like.
Exactly, who had been kicked out of Afghanistan by the Taliban and were all waiting around in Pakistan, most of them and a couple of them in Iran. And then we had this other stated goal, which was, you know, helping to develop a democratic infrastructure, as it were, the institutions of democratic government in Afghanistan. And those, the way that we pursued objective number one made it inevitable that objective number two would fail.
Well, I'm sure that people are also shocked, or maybe they're not shocked, that Reconstruction money was being given to the warlords, who were then distributing the wealth as they saw fit, and pretty much all the projects were not completed. The man in the street in Afghanistan got none of it.
Exactly. I mean, none might be a slight exaggeration, but compared to the amount of money that is sloshing around, that's exactly right. And it's a combination. I mean, again, it was a kind of shortcut an intellectual shortcut where the line that the mantra that I keep hearing is, you know, we're here to support the government. Well, we peopled, the United States in particular, peopled the government with criminals, and the notion of supporting the government means has been read to mean give the government a blank check. So as you say, we've funneled almost all Reconstruction money through these individuals who happen to hold positions that we read in institutional terms. Like, we'll say, oh, this guy's a governor, therefore he's the government, therefore I'm supposed to strengthen him. But the reality of the, you know, I mean, the provincial governors are not elected, the mayors are not elected, the president was elected, but in pretty much a one-horse race. And the only people who are elected are our provincial councils and the parliament, which really doesn't have an executive role. And it doesn't even have the degree of lawmaking role that, for example, the U.S. Congress does. So we're basically creating little dictatorships in these provinces, and the people are just at their wits' end. And what that means in the South is that since there isn't a real electoral alternative, a way of voting in an alternative to what they're experiencing, the people are turning to Taliban as a protest vote in a way. So it's not an ideological thing. this kind of resurgence that we've been seeing for the last year in pretty serious Taliban activity. It's much more a kind of exasperation with the government that people have been living under for the last 5 years.
My guest is Sarah Chase, who supposedly left journalism some years back, but she's been reporting on Afghanistan on this show. She's written a book about Afghanistan after the Taliban and now has an article in the Boston Review. I've left out some op-ed pieces and other things. She's also written Days of Lies and Roses, Selling Out Afghanistan is in the Boston Review. Well, you're in Kandahar, which was the center of the Taliban. Mm. Would this resurgence of sentiment toward the Taliban, I guess, as the lesser of two evils, that's what happened the first time, would that be stronger in Kandahar, or is this something that we might see throughout the country?
It's definitely much stronger in the south, and in particular in the region of Kandahar, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One is indeed cultural. The south is a culturally more conservative place than other parts of the country. The second reason for that is that, and I'm going to sound a little provocative in the way that I state this, but I do believe this, that fundamentally this is, you can think of this as an invasion of Afghanistan by proxy, mounted by the Pakistani government. In other words, the training camps, the leadership, all of it is being orchestrated across the border in Pakistan. Now, this invasion is enjoying some success because of the disaffection that I was just describing, but it's really being masterminded across the border in Pakistan, and Kandahar is the target. So, you know, you'll hear about other provinces immediately to the north or immediately to the west where there's quite some activity, but basically the vector is pointing at Kandahar, which is a symbolic city because it was the city where the country was founded, really. It was the first capital of Afghanistan, and it's always kind of been, I guess the term I used in my book was like the marrow of the bones of the country. It may not be the brain, it may not, but it has this, it's sort of like Philadelphia for Americans.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about Pakistan and what life is like in Kandahar, and also we'll talk a bit about conducting business in Kandahar, Sarah's business, as we continue this conversation with Sarah Chase, who's written an article called Days of Lies and Roses, Selling Out Afghanistan for the current issue of the Boston Review. Stay with us. We're back with Sarah Chase. Her latest writing is Days of Lies and Roses, Selling Out Afghanistan. It's in the Boston Review. And Sarah, you brought up Pakistan's role in Afghanistan. There's been growing opposition to President Musharraf. Do you think his problems will have an impact on his policies concerning Afghanistan? Would a successor be more likely to give support to the Taliban?
That's a really interesting question, because I do think that Pakistan is at a slightly volatile moment. I think that I was really stunned to see those pictures of lawyers, Pakistani lawyers in, you know, it's almost like a British system, so they're in robes practically, throwing rocks, because what had happened was the Chief Justice, who was doing some pretty independent, let's say, investigations, was going to be sacked. And so there was this kind of spontaneous uprising of the keepers of the law. And I found that so moving and so indicative that there is an alternative in Pakistan to either Musharraf or the mullahs. And that's the kind of boogeyman he keeps trying to wave around at us, that, like, if it's not me, then it's going to be the mullahs. Well, lo and behold, you've got a lot of people who stand up in and have street demonstrations in favor of, you know, law, constitution, you know, things like that. And so where I see the real weakness of U.S. policy has been to kind of fall for this very binary picture that General Musharraf has been painting for us. And I think that any decent future for Pakistan has got to pass by way of, guess what? Democracy. And there are plenty of people and plenty of people in Pakistan who want civilian rule, who do not, you know, the kind of fundamentalist parties are up on the border, are encouraged by Musharraf. That's the other really interesting thing, is where he presents or tries to present a kind of, I'm the good guy and the mullahs are the bad guys. What he's actually done is change electoral laws up in those two provinces that border Afghanistan to make it more likely that extreme, you know, basically militant Islamist parties gain seats in parliament, because it's a kind of sorcerer's apprentice thing. He wants to wave this thing around at us, and meanwhile, we as a, you know, country with our foreign policy are basically ignoring everything else that's going on in Pakistan. So it would really depend on what happened. You say it were to be somebody else other than General Musharraf, it would really depend. But were Pakistan to move in the direction of a more democratic political process where civilians were in control of the military, that could only, I believe, work to Afghanistan's benefit.
But hasn't Musharraf also sent in the Pakistani military into those border provinces to take on the Taliban, and also allowed the U.S. to go in there, and that seems to have hurt him with the Pakistani citizenry as well.
All of that is cinema. The leadership of the Taliban are sitting not on the border. They're sitting in Quetta, Pakistan, which is the capital of Balochistan province. And Musharraf knows exactly what apartments they live in, what cars they drive, and he doesn't turn them over, with one recent exception that there's some speculation about what happened there. But all the other stuff, all the kind of border area, the caves and all that stuff, is basically for our consumption. It doesn't have any significant impact on what's actually happening. If you take down the leadership, then, you know, the money, the organization, the training, the weaponry stops flowing. If you try, it's sort of like turning on a tap and then trying to catch the water, you know, that's like splashing onto a cement, you know, area and trying to catch the water 3 yards away from the tap. Of course, that's going to be very difficult because the water's going right, left, and center. That's the idea of trying to catch this stuff on the border. But the tap is in Quetta, and Musharraf is not interested in turning it off, and we are not interested in forcing him to turn it off.
Well, Dick Cheney went there to tell him to turn it off, didn't he?
Allegedly. Do we really know what he actually said? I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but
and you couldn't have said this when you were working for NPR, could you?
That's a good question. Certainly not in the immediate post 9/11 period, when I feel like our critical apparatus got short-circuited or something. I mean, it was amazing. It wasn't just me and NPR. It was, you know, a friend of mine in Newsweek. It was CNN, which distributed a written order not to film civilian casualties. It was the BBC. I mean, and I feel as though it's taken about four years for the journalistic establishment in the United States to wake up. I mean, we let Iraq happen too, or you guys did, not you personally, but you know what I mean? By then I was out of the business. But how did nobody question the premises upon which we went into Iraq? I do think that there is, as you pointed out, a bit of a change in tone about Pakistan. The New York Times has written some pretty, you know, has published some pretty interesting articles. Quite, and their editorial page is, I think, quite effective or accurate. Whether it's effective in changing U.S. policy, I don't know. But I also do think there's a bit of a dearth of positive alternatives, and I don't know enough about Pakistan to have an in-depth conversation with you right now about precisely the ways in which I think U.S. policy ought to shift. But it does seem to me that basically knee-jerk backing of a of a military dictator who has a track record of instrumentalizing religious extremism for purposes of a regional political agenda, kind of power agenda, is not what we ought to be doing. And
But wait a minute, Sarah. Is it only Pakistan? Because Iran also has a large border with Afghanistan, and there are many links between the two countries. Isn't Afghanistan part of this equation?
It is a bit a part of this equation, and I certainly don't want to claim that Iran hasn't meddled and doesn't meddle in Afghanistan, but I think with less of a hegemonic, is that how you say it?
Why
objective.
Not?
In other words, Pakistan, I really think, has sought for the past 25 years at least to take over Afghanistan in whole or in part by proxy. Now, quite interestingly, what I'm starting to hear very recently from some pretty disparate sources is that, oh, wow, you know, lots of the weaponry that the insurgency has, you know, in the Kandahar area is coming in from Iran. And I start to sort of scratch my head. And again, I don't want to come off like a conspiracy theorist here, but you know, as we all know, Washington is quite preoccupied with Iran at the moment, and some might even suggest that Washington is looking for a provocation in order to serve as a pretext for becoming a little bit more militarily involved in Iran. And it was quite interesting to me that I suddenly started hearing in the last, I would say, month to 6 weeks, that this weaponry way over on our side. I'm very close to the Pakistani border. I'm in the southwest of Afghanistan. Sorry, southeast. I'm in the southeast of Afghanistan, quite a ways from the Iranian border. And all of a sudden, you know, we're hearing that it's Iranian weaponry. And I started thinking, I wonder if we're not trying to concoct a pretext here, and wouldn't Pakistan be delighted? Because then all of a sudden Pakistan becomes our regional ally. I do know that Pakistani special forces are doing some activity in basically Iranian Balochistan, in the parts of Iran that border Pakistan. So there is a little bit of provocation happening there. And all of a sudden Pakistan becomes our best friend again and comes out smelling like a rose. And we don't really care so much about the Taliban if Pakistan is by our side in this latest effort to push on Iran. In that sense, yes, Afghanistan is deeply embedded in the very complex regional, you know, sort of divisions. And it's almost geographical. I mean, if you think of Afghanistan, you can think of Afghanistan as a wall dividing these three massive, basically continental areas: Iranian plateau, Indian subcontinent, and Central Asia. And there are two doors through that wall which are controlled by Afghanistan. So it's almost inevitable that Afghanistan is going to be at the crossroads of these kinds of regional tensions.
My guest is Sarah Chase, who's written an article called Days of Lies and Roses, Selling Out Afghanistan. It's in the current issue of the Boston Review. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you see a possibility that the Taliban could regain power at some time in the future?
I don't see them taking over power in the entire country. There is an ethnic divide. You asked earlier whether this is a southern phenomenon or countrywide.
Or Pashtun, for that matter.
Sorry?
Or just Pashtun part of the country?
Yeah. I mean, roughly you can divide out the southeastern half of the country is Pashtun, and the northwestern half, again, very roughly, is made up of other ethnic groups. And so those ethnic divisions are going to make it very unlikely that I think a resurgent Taliban could take over as much of Afghanistan as the Taliban owned in summer 2001, for example. However, I can imagine the Taliban basically being a proxy control, taking proxy control of the Afghan South for Pakistan. And you're hearing a lot of talk about reconciliation and what if we negotiate and this and that, which I just find breathtaking, because there are tons of former Taliban currently in government. Basically, anybody who wanted to throw in their lot with this experiment in nation building was welcome. And the people who are currently fighting are not fighting for any legitimate political, indigenous political or ideological objective. They are, as I say, proxies of the Pakistani government. So I could see a variety of scenarios, more or less violent, in which they basically take over de facto control of the South.
Wouldn't it be in the best interest of the Bush administration for Musharraf to go in and capture those Taliban members and hand them over to the United
States?
And wouldn't why are we not pressuring him more, considering the fact that we are major supporters of that regime economically?
I think that General Musharraf is very, very clever. And I think that he's realized that we have, at least up until now, been obsessed with Al-Qaeda. And from his perspective, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are very different, because Al-Qaeda had its own internationalist agenda. It, you know, pitched in Afghanistan between, you know, 1996 and 2001. It pitched in terms of training Taliban fighters and even providing fighters for the Taliban's effort to take over more and more of Afghanistan. But fundamentally, Al-Qaeda had its own program, whereas Musharraf and his predecessors were using the Taliban, as I said before, as their proxies for their agenda, which was a regional agenda to do with Afghanistan and Kashmir. So it's become very inexpensive for General Musharraf to turn over an Al-Qaeda operative to Washington about once every 3 or 4 months. And so basically I think that up until now he's been buying Washington off with a well-timed delivery of an Al-Qaeda operative. And I actually am aware quite specifically of one example of this, when I had some really precise information about basically the guy who's currently masterminding the so-called Taliban resurgence in terms of apartment, you know, the safe house that he's staying at and license plate number and things like that, which I delivered to folks at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. And I was told, I know, Sarah, but they just gave us Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was one of the masterminds of 9/11. There's nothing we can do about it. So that was a very effective ploy that I think exploited a kind of short-sighted obsession that we had with Al-Qaeda alone. Now that the results of that exploitation have been, you know, basically an entire 9 months of combat in the Afghan South, that I think British General Richards, who was in charge of all of the international troops in Afghanistan up till this past February, said was the heaviest fighting the British Army had seen, you know, certainly since the Falklands, if not before. That's hit high enough on our Geiger counter, as it were, that, you know, there are the kinds of more critical statements being made about the Pakistani government that you mentioned. And I do think that what Vice President Cheney is likely to have said, you know, again, this is, nobody was in the room, it was a one-on-one, so I wasn't a fly on the wall, but from what I'm hearing from some friends in Pakistan is that it sounded more like he was saying, look, I'm coming under a lot of pressure from the Democratic Congress kind of thing. It wasn't really that he directly bawled General Musharraf out. It was, you know, the temperature is rising just a little bit on you guys running the Taliban, so can you throw me a bone here?
Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed sure was a bone. He has confessed to almost every crime that's been committed over the last 6 months, or 6 years. Well, in your article in the Boston Review, you tell the story of Nurallah, the former head of the police force in Kandahar we've discussed in the past.
No, he was just a bodyguard for the former head of the police.
Oh, well, anyway, now he's
right.
Working
for... He was a police officer, and he's in my cooperative, right.
Because he was one of the few honest people?
Yeah. Yeah. What happened, he was a bodyguard for a close friend of mine who got assassinated last summer, who was the chief of police of Kandahar, was then moved to a northern town called Mazar-e-Sharif, which hated Pashtuns. And this guy, who was a dyed-in-the-wool Pashtun, was, you know, gruff, rough sometimes, but basically honest, very, very hardworking, and brought peace to Mazar-i-Sharif. Loved the town. The town fell in love with him. And next thing that happens is he's appointed to be police chief of Kabul, which is basically a cabinet post. And came down to Kandahar after he had been office for 2 months to pick up his family and move them up to Kabul. And he was assassinated the day after he got there. And, you know, his bodyguards were used to a certain kind of discipline. One of them just told me this amazing story that what he used to do is every once in a while he'd grab all of his bodyguards' telephones and he'd put them on his desk and he'd wait until they ring. And then he'd pick up the phone and he'd start talking to whoever called in. In other words, trying to making sure that his bodyguards weren't, you know, on the side getting involved in any kind of business that wasn't appropriate or anything like that. I mean, he was really on top of things. And this Nurullah, who was one of the kind of inner circle of bodyguards, just could not go back to the police because by comparison, it's a free-for-all.
Well, in the few moments that we have left, can you talk a bit about Argan, the cooperative you started in Kandahar? How's it doing?
It's doing great. There's a shop in Manhattan, Domus, that carries our stuff, and we actually have a waiting list of 60 stores in the U.S. and Canada. We're supplying about 10 currently. What we do is, as you said earlier, we extract oils and essential oils from licit local agriculture. So, you know, it's everything from almonds to pomegranates to, you know, and make soaps. And we're just about to add a line of skin oils. And what's happening is it's sort of creating almost community in the U.S. as well as the cooperative structure in Afghanistan, because more and more people are really interested in the way we're doing it and what we're doing, and we're very direct in terms of our communication with both our shops and our customers and people who want to help out. And so we have a wish list and people are sending us stuff. And so I feel like I'm living in this split screen where the cooperative is doing great. We're adding, we're expanding in a war zone. You know, and then meanwhile, the world around us is kind of coming apart. So it's quite a strange environment. But I do feel that what I'm trying to do is create, at least inside our walls, the kind of democracy that I wish we could have created in Afghanistan as a whole.
You said licit agricultural products. That means everything but opium poppies.
That's correct. I have to confess that I would love to make one batch of opium seed oil soap, but I have resisted that temptation so far. It is a totally integrated part of
it. It will relax the skin, I suspect. Thank you so much for talking with us again, Sarah.
It is such a pleasure. Take very good care. Enjoy your spring.
And Sarah Chase, whose current article is in the Boston Review, Days of Lies and Roses, Selling Out Afghanistan, I'm sure we'll be talking with her again real soon to find out what's really going on in Afghanistan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Len.